The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we had introduced the subject of the Chelicerata, and we were talking about the class Myristemata. I would urge you not to be put off by the big names particularly, and I will try and be careful not to bury you in them. This is simply a class within the subphylum Chelicerata that includes the horseshoe crabs, and we introduced those to you a little bit, talked about them, and several other things we'll note now. The horseshoe crabs, interestingly enough, are not segmented. Now you'll notice, you remember, if you've listened to the program for a while, that this is one of the characteristics of phylum Arthropoda. And yet here is an organism that is classified in this phylum that has no segments. And for that reason, there are some who would put it in a different phylum, but it's a little tough to do that because of the jointed feet and the exoskeleton. So it's just a dilemma in some respects for the evolutionist. The carapace, which is the same term that is used for the hard shell on a turtle, forms the front half of the body, and there are five pairs of walking legs that are found there underneath the carapace. And then there are a series of flat fused appendages under the abdomen toward the posterior of the organism. These things are opercula. That's not the term. I'm not sure there is a name for them. They're simply flat structures, and the horseshoe crab uses these for swimming, uses the feet for walking, and uses these flattened joined appendages for swimming, so it can move by either of those two processes. It has two compound eyes. They are found about halfway back on the carapace. There are two simple eyes that you will find on the front of the carapace. And they also have a long appendage sticking out of the back of the thing that is known as a telson. It is not venomous. Whether they can use it for attacking, I do not know. I really don't think so. I don't know what it's for, but it is not venomous. These organisms usually feed on worms or small mollusks, and we just find them very interesting. They, again, are unique. There is no organism, alive or fossil, that can be looked on as an ancestor for them. And there is nothing in nature today or in the fossil record that could be looked on as being descending from them. They are simply found in nature and found in the fossil record with no connection to any other organism. And this, of course, is a dilemma for the evolutionist. Why you would have people who would hang on to this idea so adamantly in spite of a lack of evidence on the one hand, and in some cases evidence that would preclude the possibility, at least at one point in my life, was very much of a mystery. The answer to that now, I think, is very simple. You have a person who rejects the idea of creation for a very simple reason. As soon as you admit the possibility of creation, then you also are faced with the necessity of a creator. And if there is a creator, then this makes you and me as people a creature subject to that creator. And the nature of the unregenerate mind is such that they simply do not want to put themselves in subjection to anybody, God or anybody else. So then they begin to dream up a scheme that presumably will provide an answer to all of the complexity and interrelationships and diverse organisms that we see in nature, without the necessity of an intelligent creator. And we have, on some programs in the past, have talked at great length about this. Paul discusses this in Romans 1 and indicates there in verse 20, I think it is, that because every person who has ever lived can see the order and pattern and complexity in nature, that as a consequence of this, there are two things they know. Number one, they know from seeing this order and pattern that there is a creator. And number two, they know he's a powerful creator. Now, that passage does not have anything to do with salvation, but it simply establishes the fact that there will never be a single person who will stand before God in judgment and shake his finger under God's nose and say, I never knew anything about you. God will say, you saw the sun come up in the morning, you saw it go down at night, you saw the order and pattern in nature, and that was sufficient to establish the fact that there was a creator. And the last part of that verse, so that they are without excuse. So you have people who simply are unwilling to accept the fact that they are creatures subject to God. And evolution then comes about as an attempt to try and find some plausible means of avoiding that. The mating process for horseshoe crabs is rather interesting. When mating time comes, the female will simply come up on the sand at high tide, dig a hole in the sand, and lay her eggs. And she will then be followed by one or more males that will crawl into the hole and simply spray their sperm cells around on the eggs. And then the female will cover up the hole and leave it. And the warm sand, warm because of the sun, will simply incubate the larvae. And at some point in the future, at high tide, they will dig themselves out and return to the ocean. I really don't know what the incubation time is, how long it takes for these to develop. It is, again, a relationship that simply could not have occurred as a matter of randomness and chaos. And we're talking here about a process that is involved with the actual maintenance of the species. One other interesting thing that's probably worth mentioning here, the larvae which hatch are sometimes referred to as trilobite larvae. In other words, the larvae of the horseshoe crabs look like trilobites. And by the way, these larvae are segmented. So the larvae are segmented, the adults are not. And this brings up a very interesting difficulty that is apparent if you go back, say, into the 1700s and look at attempts at classification there. If you can imagine yourself at that time, when microscopes are really a little hard to come by, you were pretty well stuck with whatever you can see with your eyes. So particularly with marine organisms and some freshwater organisms, you see these very peculiar, strange little creatures that are swimming around or present in the water, and very different from any adults that you know. So the early taxonomists would decide, well, this is another kind of an organism. So they would set up a system of classification for the larval stages until they determined what the life cycle was and recognized that these larvae, which were very, very different from the adults, were actually part of the developmental stages in the life cycle itself. So you have some very unusual categories of organisms that were looked on at one time as separate and are now recognized simply as a part of the life cycle of another organism that was more familiar. We were fishing out off the Outer Banks someplace, I remember several years ago, in a inlet down below one of the bridges, and a boy came by and had two of these horseshoe crabs, a large one and a small one, which I know now were a male and female, and I was trying to talk him out of one of them in order to have a specimen for our invertebrate zoo lab, and he wasn't having any of that. I assume perhaps he was interested in eating them as well, but in any case, he was carrying them by the telsons, by the way, which tells you something about their venomous lack of venom, and he was, I don't know how he got them, but he was not parting with them. So again, we see the same condition that we've noted already in arthropods, unique organisms. with no demonstrable connection to anything else. These things are sometimes referred to as ancient or primitive. They're found in Cambrian, supposedly died out about 200 million years ago, and as the trilobites were, they're simply sitting there in the fossil record. There is nothing that leads up, there's nothing that leads away. Now, the next of the organisms here, the class Pycnogonida, these are the so-called sea spiders. Very interesting. Most of them are have a thin body and long, extremely thin legs. And therein lie differences, anatomical, structural differences. They have four pairs of thin legs. By the way, the horseshoe crabs have five pair, and spiders have four pair. And this is one of the reasons that some evolutionists have tried to classify horseshoe crabs someplace else. The Pycnogonida, the thin ones, have four pair of legs. Well, the others do. We'll talk about it in a moment as well. Again, the term I think you would find in most biology textbooks, they are unique among the arthropods. In some cases, there are five or six pairs of legs rather than four. The males have a subsidiary pair of legs known as ovigers, and on occasion you will find that the males will carry the developing eggs. There are no equivalent structures on the females. Now, this pictures a relationship that we have not talked about at all for arthropoda, and when you're trying to provide an evolutionary basis for this, there is simply no way to do that. So again, we see some very unusual organisms that have habits and structures that are critical to their survival that could not possibly have occurred because of the intelligence of the organism and its ability to change its genetic material to produce them, or had them simply occur because of something in nature. And it speaks again to the idea of a complicated creation, that God made organisms, gave them the structures he intended them to have in order to be able for them to live and fit into the whole of creation as he has determined that they ought to.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.